Tonight on Arena, Bo is Afraid, Fast X and Under the Fig Trees are the movies up for review, and choreographer Emmanuel Gatt on dancing to the music of Tears for Fears. Is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. On this week's trip to the cinema, we meet a middle-aged man with mommy issues, petrol heads on yet another high-octane caper, and Tunisian teens who learn about life while harvesting figs. Now, after scaring the life out of us and cinema goers in general with Midsommar and Hereditary, Ari Aster is back with Bo is Afraid, starring Joaquin Phoenix as an outsider who's forced out of isolation when he has to, horror of horrors, visit his mummy. Rivaling the Police Academy for sheer volume of sequels, the 10th, yes, the 10th iteration of the Fast and Furious roars into cinemas. This one is called Fast X. Look what they did there. And the very nominatively determined star Vin Diesel is still calling the shots. And Under the Figs brings us a day in the life of fruit pickers in the largely improvised Tunisian film. John McGuire and Arlene Hunt sit before me now. They've cleaned up the popcorn that they spilled all over the studio floor when they came in. They are ready now to talk about this week's releases. And we're starting with Bo is Afraid from Ari Aster. Features Joaquin Phoenix as a meek, middle-aged man. John, listeners, I suppose we kind of might expect a horror film here. Joaquin Phoenix and Ari Aster kind of sounds like a marriage made in heaven.
It sounds like a horror, Sean, exactly. But it's not a horror, really. Yeah. It's a comedy. It's the funniest film that Aster has made. He's the director of Hereditary and Midsommar, like you say. Mm. And when this film was released in the US 6 or 7 weeks ago, he got some bad notices, or let's say some mixed reviews. Mm. And that's kind of appropriate because the film doesn't know if it's a horror or if it's a comedy. It is very much split down the middle between a kind of examination of this sad sack character that Joaquin Phoenix plays, Bo. Mm. He's got this frail voice, these hunched shoulders. He's living in anxiety and fear constantly. And when he misses his flight to go home and visit his mother, who's played as a younger woman by Zoe Lister-Jones and later by Patti LuPone, he has to undertake this quest to try to get there. And the film is about the quest, but it is also about Bo's state of mind. Yeah. And very funny things happen.
Yeah.
Certainly in the first half of the film, it's funny. It's mad and crazy and violent and frightening, but it's slapstick. It's right. Buster Keaton.
So in the first half of the film.
And in the second half, then we go into Bo's head and things tend to slip and get lost.
Yeah, then I wonder, do we know where we are? And it takes us quite a while to play the two halves of this film, Arlene.
Two halves, you say?
Yeah.
I'll go with third.
Oh, that
second.
Long. There are three halves, aren't
three,
there?
Yeah. I'll go with the three. Yeah, so Bo's a very unreliable narrator. You don't know if some of the stuff is happening to him is actually happening to him, or is because he's so heavily medicated and under so much duress that, you know, maybe it's happening to him, or maybe it's an existential crisis he's having, or maybe the people that he meets, maybe they are trying to help him, but in his state, he doesn't understand what's happening to him. But he meets the most bizarrest of people. And, you know, as John said, it's very funny in the opening
part
of the movie. But then it goes into almost like pastiche. Like he's rescued. Well, first he's run over by a couple, a very lovely couple, played by Amy Ryan and Nathan Lane. And then he wakes up, he's in their daughter's bedroom.
Right, well, let's have a listen to the moment when he wakes up, in fact, with the aforementioned Grace, played by Amy Ryan, and her husband Roger, played by Nathan Lane. Bo, played, of course, by Joaquin Phoenix. And he has some kind of a monitoring bracelet
around his ankle.
And that's a kind of a new, as far as he's concerned.
Well, he didn't put it on.
Yeah, well, here's what happens when he wakes up.
Am I dead?
No. You've been healing so quickly. And no organs were hit, and your bleeding was really mild.
What this is a room is?
This is a room in our house? But it's your home for as long as you need. My name's Grace. Oh, this is Roger. This is my husband.
Hey, Kai. Welcome back. Thought you'd sleep in, huh?
Roger's a very respected surgeon. He's the one who dressed and treated your wounds.
You're a lucky man.
Was What is this?
That's my little assistant health monitor. Keeps track of your condition.
Ooh, you see, now I have to say there's something very sinister about that. There's only 57 seconds of the film with three halves.
Okay, but you're waking up into that scenario. Things are not... That's not a healthy place to be.
But it's a Lynchian vibe to it. But Astor is really good at that, giving you economically and efficiently that kind of skewed universe.
He's and
really
well played good at, by Amy Ryan, Nathan Lane, and
really superb
Phoenix.
Performances. Yeah. Actually, the superb performances all the way through the film. But this is about as good as it got for me. It started to slip shortly after these sequences. He meets an acting troupe in the woods. And the show that they're about to perform eerily mirrors his own life and his own concerns and his own anxieties. And after that, the film starts to gaze at its own navel and disappears up its own fundament. And things get a bit too airy. And they're not as funny as they were. They're not as slapped. And Phoenix struggles. Absolutely full-on performance, but he struggles as the film goes on.
Thank you for your very useful... very colourful language. It was very well put without offending anybody, I'm sure.
It just disappears.
Okay. What we're talking about here, I suppose you have to think about Ari Aster and the previous work. Where does this fit in with Hereditary or Midsommar, for that matter?
In Hereditary... there's issues between the son and the mother in Hereditary.
So this is a recurring motif.
It's a motif. It comes back again and again and again. And especially, that scene over the dinner table when she really lets him have it, when when there's been a tragedy in the family and he's kind of saying that, oh, maybe you should say something to me. And she loses her mind and says, I don't want to talk to you. You sit there with that sneer on your face. And there's this anger and hostility between a son and the mother, and it bubbles over with intensity. And there's so much hostility between mother and son in this film. The elder mother is played by Patti LuPone, and Patti LuPone is just a powerhouse of malignancy in this. She's actually great fun. I quite enjoyed her performance in this because she bristles with animosity and annoyance with this shambling hulk of a son that she's produced, and she's done a real number on him when he's a kid. Like there are flashback scenes all the way through this of when he's a young man, they're on a cruise together, and just their relationship is toxic from the outset, and it hasn't improved over the years.
And the other thing, I mean, that obviously relates a lot to Hereditary there, but I'm thinking of Midsommar, and you mentioned, John, about this meeting this acting troupe in the woods, and that kind of
ritualistic thing is another motif. And there's a few others. There's the mommy issues and the communes. Head trauma is always a big thing with Aster. You've got flowers, you've got fire. These are the things that he keeps coming back to. But rather than become a retread, it's as if the things that they have in common are that his main characters always have this gradual and horrifying realization that destiny is knocking on the door and that free will has fled. And there's not a lot that Bo can do about what's going to happen. And that's probably the greatest thing that connects the three films, is this kind of this awful destiny that all of his characters have to face.
And he leaves behind a terrible trail. That's the other thing about it. He's funny, but he leaves a terrible trail.
Bo does,
a terrible trail without any real concept of his involvement in it.
Now, you keep talking about the three halves. You're referring to the 3 hours of the movie.
Yes, I am. It's 3 hours long.
Did it, I think I know the answer before I ask the question, did it hold your attention for the 3 hours? Did it pay off and stars Arlene?
No, it didn't, because there's a good film in there, I think, if it was
because I can hear frustration from both of you. It nearly has
because
brilliant,
there are some
great, nearly there, is brilliant.
There are great performances in this. There are really great performances in this. There's a lot of comedy that works really, really well. There's a lot of tensions that work really, really well. But it's so long and it drops off in the middle. The forestry, the animation, the weaving its way through this neuroses and that neuroses. And it eventually just becomes exhausting.
Yeah.
And that's what happened to me. I just found myself exhausted. But when we get to the really, really big section where, Mona comes back into it and blah, blah, blah. I'd lost all the will to live at that point, you know. All so right. I just found that a bit of a struggle, and I wanted to like it a lot more because I loved some of the performances. I loved some of the earlier parts in it, but I came out with a 2 out of 5.
How did it pan out for you, John? Because I think you can identify that it fell off the cliff at a certain point.
At a certain point, I just stopped being as interested as I was, and it never caught my attention again because it became this kind of shapeless, tangential, sometimes cartoonishly silly thing. And the more he reaches, this maximalist approach that Astor has, and the more he reaches and the more he finds that he can grab in his hands, the more that drops off the table as he's doing it. And that, to me, for all the power that the film has, certainly in the performances and certainly in some of the slapstick and the comedy, over 3 hours, like Arlene says, it creates this kind of weariness that does the film no favour. Okay. So it was 3 out of 5 for me. First half of it is so close to being a great film.
So most of the 3 are for that first half of the film.
Most of the 3 would be certainly shown for the first half. And then by the end of it, you're like,
you're lost. Okay, Bo is Afraid, our first film this evening. Let's move on then to Fast X, the 10th instalment of the FFCU. And that's Fast and Furious Cinematic Universe, for fear you think I'm saying something else. Vin Diesel is ever present as Dom, and we're told this is the first of 3 concluding films. 13.
Woohoo.
Looking for. It'll be 12, will be the third
what
one.
Is?
Yeah,
because yeah, if he's 10 ever is. Stop,
is 10 is number 1, 11 is number 2.
There are no breaks.
Yeah. Okay. Arlene, you have your furrowed brow, your head is in your hand as you're even thinking about having to talk about this film. Just give me the setup before you.
Okay. No, I will.
Before you go at it.
So, the setup. The plot. Do you want the plot?
Yeah.
Is there a plot?
Is there? That could be interesting. Plot. Okay, yeah. So 10 years before, in the Fast and the Furious history, Dominic Toretto and Paul Walker, as character at the time, they're in Rio de Janeiro, they used their cars, they robbed a huge vault of money, and they escaped with the vault of money. And the very bad man who they stole the money from went chasing after them, and also so did his son. His son is named Dante and is played by Jason Momoa.
Yeah.
So as luck would have it, they're driving on a road, they're driving very fast, they do some sort of amazing manoeuvre with wires, and then the very bad man gets killed. And Dante is thrown into a river where he drowns for a while, but then miraculously comes back to life, but with vengeance in mind.
Oh, right.
And okay. So the whole concept is, now we've moved back away, and now Dom and Letty, who's played by Michelle Rodriguez, they are, and I'm going to use the word family here because I feel I must, they have a family now, and this is very important to this film, family becomes a motif all the way through this film. It's used in every other sentence, so I'm going to use it here. And so they have a family. And so when Dante comes back, he doesn't want them to die because that would be too boring. He wants them to suffer.
Ah, yeah, but he's been, it sounds as if there's a metaphor here. Has he been in through the circles of hell, this character, Dante? Me wonders. Let us have a listen to a face-off between Vin Diesel as Dominic Toretto and Jason Momoa as Dante. Both harnessing some kind of voiceover technique that could make you a fortune, I'd say, if you could get it regularly.
You remember my father?
Hernan Reyes.
My father was a horrible man.
Very bad daddy.
But I kind of liked him, and you took him from me when you stole our money and left us with nothing but suffering.
Well, that's what I came here for. And their suffering.
Oh, and I didn't take that money.
I burned it.
That's Vin Diesel. what are they at? Did they act at that type of raspy, low voice mumble the whole way through?
This is the high drama, Sean.
Dramatic moment.
You've got to express
your
how terrible the situation is and how keenly you feel it.
Well, they could shout at each other, which would be
they do a fair
more
bit
about.
Of shouting. They do a fair bit of driving and a fair bit of crashing into things. A lot of the stuff blows up. Yeah. They do in the opening sequence roll a circular neutron bomb through Rome and almost destroy the Vatican, which is fun, I suppose.
Well, you see that you're both now. You have to cut this cynicism and smart aleck.
No, I'm not.
This is an action movie. Of course, things are going to blow up. Of course, a neutron bomb is going to roll through Rome.
I know,
and of course, there's going to be great action. Surely, that's what it's about, rather than subtle characterization.
I lost interest in the Fast and the Furious franchise at around the same time as they abandoned the physical laws of the observable universe to become this flagrant succession of impossibilities.
What do you mean? That's the bit where I saw in the trailer where he drives down the wall of a dam
exactly,
and reverses back up. Yeah. Okay, he's not able to. You can't do that.
They
can't
put
that.
A car in space in
they
one
did
of them.
They put a car into
they
space.
They put it in space and drove it around
them.
In space.
Elon Musk will be doing that before we know it.
But there, this is the issue with the film, is that when you're watching an action movie, you have some basis and some grounding in the physical laws of the universe. And this, they've decided that that doesn't apply to them. So it becomes a kind of a Looney Tunes cartoon. You expect Bugs Bunny to
but
pop
is, isn't that, like, it says it on the tin, Fast and Furious. I mean, it's not they slow do, and subtle. That's not
yes,
what it is.
Yes, once, Sean, but 10 times. We've had to see this 10 times now. Okay, and when you consider that there isn't enough narrative material here for a scene in what we will unsneeringly refer to as a normal film, and they've stretched that over almost 30 hours of cinema.
Let us forget Fast and Furious 1 to 9, because we're talking about Fast and Furious 10.
Fast 10, your seatbelt.
Or Fast 10. Oh, Fast 10, your seatbelt. Look what you did.
There you go.
I'll be very busy. Well, like, could you go to Fast 10 and just enjoy it for what it is?
If you like
popcorn
that type,
and bubblegum
for the
eyes.
If you like that type of movie, if you're happy enough just to go along for the crashes and the explosions and the bombs and the scantily dressed ladies and the growling, snarling, machismo fellas, you know, if that rocks your boat, then you're probably going to have a good time with this movie, and that's the reality.
This is where I would have a problem, is that no, you're not, because it's not good enough. There is this section of cinema exists, and no, you know.
Oh, I know. There are better examples of this.
This film cost $340 million to produce, and you don't see any of it on the screen. The effects work is dreadful. The script is garbage. They've just recycled everything that they ever had. Almost every character that has ever appeared in this franchise.
What's interesting
pops
is when Charlize
gets one scene.
Yeah, when Charlize Theron, and this is what I thought was interesting, when Charlize Theron pops up as Cypher, and fans of the franchise will know her straight away. She pops up aside, the whole film is lifted almost straight away.
Yes, again, that formative
Helen Mirren pops up.
Helen Mirren,
exactly.
Yeah. They can act.
And Brie Larson is in there too. Presumably, all of these people,
all Oscar winners, and but the dialogue, the things that they have to say to one another, are rubbish. But that's okay in action cinema.
Okay,
it's just that it's so familiar.
Let's because you mentioned the theme of family coming back.
Yes,
at
I
us
did.
Time. I think that might be in this little.
I stopped
that I
after
have
17. I heard it 17. I was counting up until I got to about 17,
and
I just
stopped.
Said I should kind of stop now.
Well, here's Dom, played by Vin Diesel. He meets Tess, played by Brie Larson. And he's asking her to free Letty, who's...
His wife.
Yeah, that's his wife.
Michelle Rodriguez.
Yeah, his family.
Part
of his family.
Family,
okay. So he passes her a set of beads with a cross. And this is the little conversation they have.
Letty.
Letty's in a black site prison off of every map.
Then get her out.
Nobody can.
Nobody would.
Dom, I'm so sorry, but... What you're asking me to do is impossible.
Nothing's impossible. You just have to have faith.
Family. Faith and family.
And really smulchy music playing behind you as well that, while you're saying that.
You need that for the emotion. I actually started, and this is not the word of a lie, every time Jason Momoa came on screen, I started to use the music from The Simpsons, you know, where Sideshow Bob comes on. It's like, din, 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 din. And that just made it much better for me every time I saw him. That's all I did.
That's ridiculous. He needs to tell you, he needs to put his shirt on, as well.
I know I only watched 4 minutes of but it was quite a long trailer to be said, to has to be said.
It just felt longer.
Four and a half minutes.
I wish I'd just watched the trailer, Sean, to be honest.
I have
to
say, you know, some of the action sequences, I thought, God, that's. I knew there's loads of CGI and all of that in there, but you kind of thought, is there a bit of fun to be knocked out of it at all, Arlene?
Oh, yeah. Well, look.
No,
as I
apart
said,
from laughing at
no,
it.
No, but as I said, like, I think fans of the franchise will get a kick out of it, because I don't think they're going to. They're not going into it for like the great dialogue. They're not going into it. They're going in to see Dom relentlessly go up against the bad guy and
drive a car up a wall. Yeah.
Yeah, and drive a car up a wall with flames and do ludicrous stunts in, like, you know, high octane engines and V8s and all this kind of stuff. And that's what people want to see. And to be honest with you, it's not great. But people will go along and they'll just go, this is great crack, altogether.
That sounds as if it might have a double star rating in that. The star rating you would give it and the star rating fans of Fast and Furious would give it.
Like I said, it wouldn't be for me, and that's being honest about it, because I just thought that there just wasn't a plot. So I just gave it 2 out of 5 for the stunts.
For the stunts, John?
I didn't pass the NCT for me, Sean. No, not roadworthy at all. 1 star. it's predictably ridiculous. We know that going in. But it is utterly pointless in and of itself. It doesn't justify its existence for 2.5 hours. You were saying about watching the trailer. That's okay on your TV or on your laptop.
Yeah,
but when you see it in IMAX, projected in IMAX, Louis Leterrier, the guy who directed this, who made the
Transporter
series, which I quite enjoy.
Jason Statham is in this, by the way.
Yeah. The effects work when you see them, you know, on a screen, on a 70 screen, foot tall. It just looks really shabby.
Yeah, there was one, I must admit, one when I thought, I wonder what that looks like on the big screen. Yeah. It was a big, big explosion.
Really bad.
Anyway, okay. I think we get the message that neither of you were jumping up and down about that one. But finally, a Tunisian film called Under the Fig Trees, which charts a day in the life of a group of fruit pickers and documents the concerns of their lives from gossip to romance to politics. I just love the sound of this. It's a group of fruit pickers sitting under fig trees, obviously talking about life. What else would you be at after you finished picking the figs? It goes right across the generations.
Yeah, there's a mixture of people at this. There's very young 17-year-olds, 18-year-olds, young teenage girls. There's an older generation of women there as well. There's a lot of older men there as well. And they're all picked up in the morning in these kind of like what looks really like cattle trucks, you know, these old Isuzus, and they're driven out to this huge farm with fig trees where the boss of them has rented the farm from one of the boys' actual uncles, which we don't find out until kind of slightly later in the film. And then it's all about the relationships between the pickers. And what seems kind of blandly sweet and quiet at the start of it shifts and changes very quickly. Yeah. You know, even into I was having a look at some of the press screenings to go with this, and even the movement of picking figs. You know, the director was saying, like, you have to be super careful. You can only pick a fig once. They're so delicate. They're so delicate. They bruise so easily. And I just thought, well, so do teenage girls. And it's just all the way that it's handled. It's beautifully. Yeah, it's absolutely gorgeous.
It's a great stage. Under a fig tree and the orchard itself. It's just a perfect stage. And she doesn't deviate from it at all.
And the she that we're talking about here is
Rigi Sahiri, the writer and director.
Yeah. And she has chosen non-professional actors.
Non-professionals. Mostly improvised dialogue as well. They talk, you know, they talk as they would talk. There is one particular, you know, we meet them all in the first third or so.
Fide, who's the kind of
this is Fide, played by Fide Fidil. And she's this open-faced young woman with this red scarf tied around her head. And it's her relationships with the other women and a few of the men that serve as a kind of a framework around which Sahiri builds this discussion about gender and patriarchy and traditional conservative Muslim Tunisia and their place in it now and their dreams for what they wanted to be in the future, which is really, really interesting stuff coming from as it occurs to them themselves in these kind of workshopped improvised situations.
Given that it sounds, you have this constant action of the picking of the figs and I guess the rest periods when they're not picking the figs and you have little groups that can break off. Is there enough drama or enough of a, maybe it's not a plot-driven drama, is there something else driving us to watch it?
There are factions, because these are young women, and young women, they have different driving factors behind them. Some of them want to get married, some of them think that's ridiculous and a waste of time and look how the world's... These are also quite traditional women. They're in a traditional place where they live and where they work, but they all have iPhones and they all have their bits and their bobs and they all know there's a world outside this. And as Fide says to Abdul, one of the younger men who comes back, he's living in a different town but a more modern place where there's tourists and it's a coastal town, and she wants to know about that life because it's not a life that she has. Her life is drudgery unless she escapes to school. Which is, you know, for a Western person is like, really? That's your escape?
Yeah.
And it's the other thing about being in under the fig trees is it's slightly suffocating underneath there.
In the canopy.
Yeah, and it's slightly suffocating. You just think, well,
the Arab Spring is never mentioned, but that's the context. This is very much a post-Arab Spring film, and that is the context.
But it's not, dealt with,
But I just want to say, John, this is a subtle film and a gentle film, but I wouldn't confuse that with any kind of weakness. This is very firmly expressed.
Oh no, I can get from both of you that it's a great watch.
I was
reminded, John,
watch,
I think you reviewed it at the time as well. Alcaraz,
Spanish film,
which was just a family on a farm, a similar type of thing.
And it was a very slightly different dynamic in that they were losing their farm through
there was more of a plot of land developers. Yeah.
And it was really an interrogation of that kind of land grab that's going
on.
So
is this a political interrogation, but done so very subtly in terms of the dynamic within the group, the patriarchy within the group.
Precisely,
and
Sean,
this
yeah.
suffocating umbrella.
You're asking the questions about the society that they have to the people who are living in the society. And that's how she structured the film. It's quite direct and it's quite firm. But at the same time, subtle and beautiful. And I thought the photography was really spectacular here.
Yeah.
I mean, and these are a first-time filmmaker and a first-time
And she was working around actual pickers.
As the harvest was going on.
So she was making this film within a film, within a work environment, you know, and it just looks completely natural.
And as you are saying, Arlene, if you have all this delicacy about the picking, you can pick the fig once and that's it.
That's it. That's your scene. And don't break the branch.
There's scenes in it, and you can actually hear.
So the branches are thick.
Yeah.
So there's a history there in those branches. They take a long time to grow. They're very precious. So anytime you hear a crack of a branch, you almost flinch with it. You know, it's just that it's devastating.
Yeah. Okay, well, that does. I mean, that you have definitely sold this one to me. I presume they don't tell us how they get the figs into fig rolls at the end.
No, that's not mentioned.
I thought it mightn't be. Stars from you on
four
this one.
Four out of five for me, thank you.
Four out of five.
Mm-hmm. Three for me. The delicacy with which they address the issues is entirely natural. It's almost effortless, actually. And the sense of being part of a shared experience is palpable, too. I thought she could have been a little harder on them. I thought they...
Right, because they had it in.
Particularly the men and particularly the older women. They kind of get away with it a little bit.
Okay.
So three for me. But three for me, you'll find it on IFI at Home and Curzon Home Cinema.
So Curzon Home Cinema and IFI at Home for Under the Fig Trees, while the other two, surprise, surprise, Bo is Afraid and Fast X, go on general release this weekend. Thank you to John McGuire and Arlene Hunt for that. Andrew Motion was UK Poet Laureate from 1999 to 2009, and he is the co-founder of the online Poetry Archive. Since 2015, he has made his home in the US, Baltimore, Maryland to be precise, where he lectures at Johns Hopkins University. We spoke to Andrew in 2020 about his poetry collection, Randomly Moving Particles. Tonight, we talked to him about Sleeping on Islands, his new memoir, which examines, among other things, his relationships with other poets, including Philip Larkin and Ted Hughes, and which asks many a philosophical question about time, about death, and about poetry itself. Also out this month is New and Selected Poems, 1977 to 2022, featuring work from Andrew's poetry collections, from Secret Narratives up to Randomly Moving Particles, as well as some new poems. Delighted that Andrew Motion joins me now from the US. We'll talk a little bit of the memoir to start out, Andrew, called Sleeping on Islands. And tell me a little bit about that, just that title and the concept of that title.
Thank you very much. Well, it's great to be with you again. That's the first thing I want to say. And a real pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. The title came more or less last of all the things I wrote to do with the book. I had great difficulty working out what to call it. But in the end, I decided that this was a phrase that said something about leading a life which is, if not quite single, at least sort of narrowly focused in its concentration on poems in the book, and also something about the locations in which it's set. The book actually begins on the island of Skyros in Greece, where I went in a kind of pilgrimage-like way at the age of 17 with a couple of school friends to look for, of all things, the grave of Rupert Brooke, which is on that island. So it has a kind of geographical application as well as a more, as it were, thoughtful, philosophical one.
Yeah, but I guess what it touches on for me, for some reason, I feel like if I'm I'm imagining these almost cloud-like islands that I'm sleeping on when I hear sleeping on islands. And I seem to be in a kind of a timeless place, maybe a place of sleep, a place of dreams. I wondered how particularly the concept of time fed into what you were writing about in the memoir. It's not that you start, this happened on such and such a day, and the next day this happened. You don't take that linear approach. Time is a very fluid thing in this memoir.
That's right. And that is certainly my experience of time. And I'm very glad that you felt what you have just described as you thought about the book. I wanted there to be something not exactly ethereal about it, but something sort of cut loose. So that the person speaking the book, which is, of course, me, is speaking about things which have happened in my life, has both a very close and obvious involvement with the things being talked about, but also I hope, a kind of objectivity about them as well, particularly in the matter of reporting on other poets I've known who appear, as you said in your introduction, who appear in the book, Philip Larkin especially.
And
I wanted the book to be, in that respect, affectionate and sort of warm and close up, but at the same time, as I also say, to have a degree of objectivity about it.
Yes, and certainly, and I will come to the particularly the Philip Larkin sections are very important in terms of your own as a life and poetry, which is the subtitle, or I suppose the addendum to the Sleeping on Islands part of the title.
Yes.
But it is rooted. You know, I need to be clear, so unless people think, oh, this sounds like something totally esoteric that I won't know what Andrew Motion is talking about half the time. It's rooted in very much in a reality, not least of which is the reality of the terrible horse riding accident that your mother had while you were a teenager. You might describe that accident and in many ways how that accident has hung over you for a large part of your life, it struck me.
All my life, I think it's probably fair to say, though I hope not always hanging over me in the same sort of ways. And it was a traumatic event. And perhaps, this is all said with hindsight, of course, but perhaps because, like my brother, I was rather encouraged by the people around me to stiffen my upper lip and kind of get through it in the immediate aftermath of the accident itself. Perhaps I should save to give this some specificity. It was a riding accident. My mother fell off her horse and bashed her head very hard and lay unconscious for a long time and then regained some sort of consciousness and lingered for longer. The whole experience went on, in fact, for 9 years. And at the end of that, she eventually died. So, yes, it was a traumatic experience for us all involved in it. And I think that there's not very much question that it's been one of the most, if not the most, sharply defining event in my life. It's made me think, among other things, very deeply about the elements in your previous question about how we deal with time, not just in the sense of how we deal with time's ravages, but whether we think of our existences as happening in a logically progressive moment-by-moment kind of way, or whether we think of them as more of a sort of hodgepodge of things happening.
Yeah.
I think I find as I've got older that the hodgepodge has rather gained the upper hand, I must say. I don't really think of my life as proceeding in a strictly linear way, of course, although it does do that in certain obvious respects, but of much more to do with darting around from here to there and back again.
Yeah, and it strikes me as you describe that that nine-year period, which I hadn't thought about until I heard it coming from your mouth, in fact, just now. People in recent times speak about that lockdown period in and around the pandemic, time became suspended and we kind of lost all rootedness in terms of time. It sounds from that phrase that you used describing it just now, that 9 year period might have been a kind of a time suspended type of period for you and your family.
I'm sure that's right. I mean, it's easy to be wise after the event, isn't it? But insofar as I can be sure about anything, I'm sure about that. And although, of course, like my father and my brother, I felt pretty devastated when my mother did die. Nevertheless, there was a kind of, merciful release is the phrase that people use, isn't it? Mm. Aspect to this. I think I've always said to myself that I'm allowed to use that phrase myself, though I rather resist it whenever anybody else uses it.
Yeah, because I guess there is an accompanying guilt to using such a phrase.
Sure. Absolutely no question about that. That's exactly right, I think. I mean, perhaps I can just say in response to your saying these things that one of the ways in which I think this has influenced this book in particular is that it helped me to decide to write the book in quite short little sections rather than in something which gave the illusion of a more joined up, as I say, progressive or consequential kind of reaction to experience. I don't want people listening to get the idea that I madly nip from one thing to another, but I thought if I did it in these little sections, as it were, like prose poems, in fact, some lasting a couple of pages, some lasting half a page, that I'd be able to give a feeling of intensity to the whole operation, but also to reflect something of what I feel about the passing of time and how I experience the passing of time.
Your mother, not ironically, and in some ways not surprisingly, your mother handing a poetry book into your hands as a young teenager was a seminal moment in terms of your development and your embarking on the road to poetry and a life in poetry. But there is no doubt that the meeting with Philip Larkin, just to go to, since you have mentioned him, and he is an important figure, a very important figure in this book as well. Mm. The meeting with him was another huge moment in terms of life, where the past and the present and the future all fed into that moment, yes. I'm sure.
Yes, that's right. I mean, they're connected, these two thoughts, I think, in no doubt several ways. But one that strikes me is that because of what happened to my mother, and because my father was a rather silent and by force of circumstance often absent person, absent at work and so on, the life that I imagined for myself, which was a life that had somehow or other to do with poems, was a very, very long way away from the way in which I was brought up. My parents were absolutely not readers. In fact, my father used to claim accurately that he'd read half a book in his life. I can remember this book because he often used to bring it on holidays, some of them in Ireland indeed, and impatiently turn over some pages while the rain was falling, and then when the rain stopped, throw it aside and get back to what he really liked doing, which was going fishing and that sort of thing. So I had to reinvent myself in quite dramatic ways in order to lay any sort of hand on the life that I wanted for myself. So going to work in Hull in the English department there, which was my first job after leaving university, was made all the more attractive as a possibility by the fact that Larkin had already been, by the time I arrived, librarian there for 20 years. And meeting him, becoming rather against the run of play, because his reputation for being a rather reclusive kind of guy was very well earned. But meeting him and becoming his friend against the run of play, no doubt had an element to it of, how am I going to say this, sort of father figures, that comes into it anyway.
The other aspect that struck me was the death of Philip Larkin's mother fed directly and had you respond almost directly to your own mother's death. When I say it, it doesn't sound that surprising, but there is something there's something quite poignant about the way you express that in the memoir.
I hope so, and I'm glad you feel that. Of course, writing about anybody else, you don't want to kind of lay claim to them in any overly possessive way, or to suppose for a moment really that the things that you as an individual feel about your own life are necessarily closely resembled by the experiences that other people have. I mean, there might be a sort of basic resemblance and similarity, but you can't assume that your own experience exactly matches anybody else's. Nevertheless, I was aware of what you say about the relationship between Philip and his mother and my relationship with my own, except, of course, they happened at very different times in our life. Philip was more or less at the end of his writing life when his mum died, and I was right at the beginning of mine.
Oh, have I lost you there, Andrew? Oh, yeah, you're back. You're back there. Can you hear me okay, Andrew?
Yes, I can hear you fine. Thank you. I'm sorry to be 3,000 miles away from you.
No, not at all. I just lost you briefly. Larkin is an important figure in there. Also an important set of stories you tell in and around, you know, the idea when Ted Hughes was leaving shedding his mortal coil, that the moment came when you realised, oh, this laureate thing might be coming my way. And did you have to do that awful thing almost of sitting down and say, here are the pluses, here are the minuses, let's look at both pages and make a decision?
I absolutely did do that. I mean, literally, I did that. I've done it at various times in my life about what felt like crucial things. And in the plus column, perhaps I can start with the minus column. In the minus column, I thought, all poet laureates get a lot of stick, whether they like it or not, whether they deserve it or not. Can I bear the thought of that? Can I bear the thought of transforming myself from a person who likes their privacy and a reasonably quiet life to somebody who has to spend an awful lot of time with their face turned fully to the world, sitting on trains, getting up early to do work for poetry and so on and so forth? And in the plus side, I thought, because there was an understanding that I would, for the first time in the history of the Laureate, be doing this for 10 years, I could actually interpret the role in a more distinctly job-like way than perhaps my predecessors had done. And as soon as I started to think about it like that, I realized that there were things that I wanted to do for poetry, if I can put it like that, which the role might give me the opportunity to realize that as a not laureate writer would have been much more difficult. And the Poetry Archive is the obvious example of that. I wouldn't have been able to create that
without the laureate chip.
Had I not have the, as it were, the authority of the position behind me.
And you do address the famous rap that you wrote for the important person.
Infamous, I think. Better.
Yeah, infamous might be the better word to use. You do address that, and you give us some funny incidences in around that too. You refer to your marriages as well, and give us lots of insights into the lives and deaths of those marriages. But I want to finish with a poem, but before I do that, there is one final question I would like to ask you about your mother, because it really struck me when how she is present for so long. The fact that on her coffin was written Catherine Gillian Motion, when all she was ever called was Gilly, must have given you this sense of, is that my mother at all that's in there? And I don't mean to be crass in the way I'm saying that, but sure. You know, this sense of, no, the Gilly, the mammy, the mom, whatever you call her yourself, that right. I know, it, no, exactly. That's not where she is.
Exactly. Well, I'm sure everybody has some version of this thought as they see their parents go out of their lives. The feeling that they are saying goodbye to something definite, realizable, and all those sorts of things, and at the same time entering a new world where a kind of ghostly presence becomes possible. The business of her being miscalled on the coffin, or called not by the names that any of us knew her, was really a way, and noticing that in the book, was really a way of trying to establish that sort of difference. And perhaps I can just go on to say that one of the slightly complicated things about coming to live in America now, 8 years ago, initially at least, was that I needed to bring my ghosts with me. I got used to living with my ghosts, and once I got here, I quite consciously found myself, after I noticed that this was something that my psyche needed to do, writing poems about my parents in order to, as it were, habituate them to being by proxy Americans as well.
Would you mind, Andrew, to finish up, because I've gone over time on our discussion, would you mind, could you read a section of Among the Others for us? Would it make sense to set up one of the sections for
absolutely.
Us, please?
Absolutely. Well, this is a little poem that you kindly asked me to read, called Among the Others, which is in three short sections, one of them about starlings, one of them about fireflies, and one of them about cormorants. And I'll just read the middle bit of it, which is only seven lines long. This is the part about fireflies. Perhaps there are now fireflies in Ireland after its climate change works its damages, but I don't think I've ever seen any in Ireland.
And no,
I
certainly not yet.
Didn't see any. Not yet. And I certainly didn't see any in London either. So fireflies are a kind of new thing for me. And I just, all I wanted to do was, in these three little poems, was to evoke the various creatures concerned and place myself among them with all due respect for my fellow species. So here we go. Sparking up in their wisteria sleeping quarters, fireflies are no match for the enormous night falling. Think of them instead as a treasure hoard, walled up centuries ago, and now reflecting something of the lamp a thief has hoisted in astonishment.
And that's Andrew Motion reading the middle section from his poem Among the Others, one of the new poems in his recent New and Selected Poems, 1977 to 2002, published by Faber and Faber, and his memoir Sleeping on Islands, A Life in Poetry, out now as well. Both of them, in fact, published by Faber, and a joy to have Andrew on the programme with us this evening. Thank you so much, Andrew. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. All around me are familiar faces, worn out places, worn out faces. Yeah, Yes, Mad World from Tears for Fears, and the music of that 1980s band is the backdrop to Love Train 2020, a dance show created by the Emmanuel Gatt Dance Company. Love Train 2020, a contemporary musical for 13 dancers where we're told people come together, drift apart, push, pull, hold back and resolve to march on. It will play Dublin as part of the Dublin Dance Festival. Promises to be a feast for the senses. Delighted to be joined by the choreographer of Love Train 2020, Emmanuel Gatt's Mad World, as we heard there, Emmanuel, The Prisoner, Ideas as Opiates, all very evocative songs from Tears for Fears. How did that band and those songs come to inspire you for this show, Love Train 2020?
Hi, good evening. Well, this is kind of my teenage years music, so it's music I knew very well. I haven't listened for it for years and years and years, and I kind of stumbled upon one of their songs, Sowing the Seeds of Love, quite by accident, and I was like, wow, this is actually really, really good music. So I kind of went back and dove into their older albums, I was fascinated like how well this music aged or didn't age, actually, how relevant it is in terms of like the musical aspect, but also the text, etc. You know, it's still a mad word, apparently. And we did it during COVID, so it was like, yeah, so fitting. It's like,
yeah.
Yeah, it is a mad world.
And I wonder to what extent when you were re-listening to the music and re-listening to the songs and you're thinking about, I'm going to make a show out of this, I'm going to make this Love Train 2020 is going to be the show that comes out of it. Are you listening to lyrics? Are you listening to the music? How do those two elements, particularly of popular music, feed into choreography? Because previously, I think most of your music has been classical music or from a classical background in terms of the music you've choreographed to.
I use different musics over the year, a lot of classical music, but also jazz, electronic music. I never worked with pop music, and it was quite interesting to see how much more complicated it is. The work I did, the piece I did before was with contemporary music like Pierre Boulez, Rebecca Saunders, etc. Like, and it was far easier than to choreograph to that than it was to Tears for Fears. So that was actually quite a surprise, but very interesting challenge.
Yeah, why do you think, how was it harder to choreograph to Tears for Fears?
Because it's a very direct music. It's kind of, it sucks the air out of the space, like it takes the entire space. It's really hard not to fall into just making like a music video kind of dance to it, like to go into dialogue with it, not to let it completely take over and then just like try to do something in terms of dance just fits what you hear, but rather keep the autonomy of the choreography, keep the autonomy of the music and make the two dialogue. It was quite challenging, but very interesting.
Yeah, and I saw some extracts of it today online, and indeed, there's one extract I think you have of a period during rehearsals. And if the music was sucking the air out of the room, it has to be said that you and your dancers were pumping a lot of energy right back into right back into that room. It is.
Yeah, we had to. Yeah,
it's high octane stuff.
There's a lot of ups and downs. I use different tracks, so some of them are much more like airy and take their time. There's some long stretches of silence also, like in between, because it's like 70 minutes and you can just have that music going on for 70 minutes. It's like almost too much for the ear, especially in a context of a theater with a big sound system. So there's like the stretches of silence when basically all you hear is the dancers breathing and moving, etc., and then the music come back. So there's like, yeah, it was an interesting process to try and kind of figure out how to use that music.
I was also quite struck by the flamboyance and the color of the costumes and the design of the piece. Is that something that Tears for Fears brought out, or is that a kind of a, without being facile about it, a default position? Do you like the flamboyance of colorful costumes and colorful design?
That actually was like, it came out of a collaboration with the designer, which is actually one of the dancers in the piece, Thomas Bradley. And it's the third time we worked together and designs the costumes for the company, for my pieces. And I kind of gave him a completely free hand. And I told him, just work separately with each one of the dancers, see which direction they wanna go. And then he kind of made it a tailor kind of fitted thing for each one of them. The only thing I told him, I told him, make it like it's a gala evening thing, like the most like extravagant thing each one of them would kind of want. And then I actually only saw the costumes when they were ready. So he really had free hand, and he took this very, a lot of layers, a lot of colors, very Baroque kind of style. And yeah, but it actually works amazingly with the music. So yeah.
And the other aspect of this is I'm interested in your actual approach to working on the dance floor. You don't come in with, okay, this is a Paddy Catherine. We're going to have four people up here. You go over there.
No.
You go
into. You, no.
What is the process for you when you're working in the rehearsal space?
Well, the process is to make sure I come with none of this. I come without any plan or kind of end vision of how I want it to look. I have 13 dancers in front of me. That's already so much material to work with. So I start from that. And like the piece is actually created while we are creating it. I don't know where it's going to go. And it's, a lot of the time I'm quite surprised by the reactions of the dancers will have to certain tasks I will give them. And then we kind of discover the thing as we go along. I don't really have an end vision. And then it keeps changing. Like if you would see the video of the premiere and you would see 3 years now after, a lot of things changed, complete sections, we just threw them, we replaced them with other things. The dancers had a lot of freedom inside also to keep changing, keep adapting. So it's kind of a living organism. So it keep kind of adjusting itself and fine-tuning itself as we perform it.
So should I be calling it Love Train 2023 then, in fact, for this manifestation in Dublin?
In a way, absolutely. It will be more accurate. Yeah, because it's alive, you know? It's like a human being. It's like it keeps changing with time, even if though it's the same person, but 3 years have gone by, it's not exactly the same person anymore.
And I think so that probably it probably is part of the power that you hand over to the dancers to be part of that creative process. It's not you as choreographer dictating what happens.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's they are on stage, it's not me on stage. So in a way, like their part in telling their own stories and having their own opinions and making their own decisions is something that is it's very important to me. And it's important also because I think artistically it will produce something which is much more authentic and much more alive and much more interesting and will engage them in a completely different way than if they were just to follow my orders and obey whatever I put down. So there's a very kind of horizontal system in which we work.
Yeah.
Decentralizing a lot of the responsibilities, decision making, resources, and then it's the kind of the sum of all the people that are involved.
Well, listen, lovely to speak with you this evening, Emmanuel, and safe trip. Hope you make it safely here, and look forward to seeing the show when it gets here. Love Train 2020 by the Emmanuel Gatt Company plays the Abbey Theatre for two nights next week, May the 27th and the 28th. More information on DublinDanceFestival.ie. That is our lot for this Thursday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Ruth Kennington was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7 once again here on RT Radio 1. And Ray Cudahy will be with you from Cork after the news.